Today on Vox Talks Economics, what is a meaningful life? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And find clips and more information on Instagram at Vox Talks Economics. What is a meaningful life? Is it about health, friends or family, or something else? Do rich people have more meaningful lives than poor people? Do we find meaning in success or problems and failures too? During the Great Depression, the US government's Federal Writers Project dispatched a team of writers across the US with a simple brief: talk to people and write down what they tell you about their lives. If that sounds like a massive waste of time, well, you could not be more wrong. Today, what those writers discovered is contained in an archive called American Life Histories. It's a record of lives lived, often in extreme hardship, that tells us about the day-to-day experience of American citizens, many of them immigrants, at the beginning of the 20th century. But can it tell us what had meaning to that generation? A new project uses artificial intelligence to discover what these documents can tell us about, well, let's call it, the meaning of life, and it is published as a CEPR discussion paper. David Lagarkas of Boston University and Joachim Voth of the University of Zurich, both CEPR fellows, were two of the researchers behind this ambitious project. When I spoke to them, I first asked David about the history of American Life Histories.
It was created by the Roosevelt administration as part of the New Deal during the Great Depression.
My most immediate concern is in carrying out the purposes of the great work program just enacted by the Congress.
And they were trying to put writers to work. And they weren't really professional writers. They were literate people. They were just people that needed work. And the first job was to get them to write something. What they actually wrote was secondary. They were trying to generate jobs.
Its first objective is to put men and women now on the relief rolls to work.
And they came up with a bunch of ideas of what to write. And then somebody said, hey, let's interview a bunch of older people and get their stories. And it sounded good. And it was good. They're great stories.
Reading these reports, well, no two are alike. This isn't dry market research. Some of the transcripts read like short stories.
It was fairly unstructured. So the main thing was to let people tell their story in their own words. That's literally what the instruction says. And it's very little else. And then they just went out and recruited people wherever they could find them, on streetcars, the corner store, bars on the street, by knocking on doors. So it's a pretty wide range of people, men and women. They come from almost every U.S. state, north and south.
While I was in Brownwood with Dad, I met a cowboy, and I married him. His name was Robert Lindsay. We've lived together ever
since. Work all hours. It's not as bad as in the old days, naturally.
No, I reckon I was born to work in a mill. Started when I was 10 years old. And I aim to keep right on just as long as
there's even a tendency
able
to make it a six-day week in this industry. And maybe 5 days eventually.
My wife and I are happy less to sit here on the porch and read and have our children and grandchildren come to see us. We're homebodies, sort of contented, like, and happy.
They wanted older people, so the vast majority are over 50. We have people that are, in terms of socioeconomic status, pretty representative of the U.S. So we actually score them based on the jobs that are recounted and compare them to the census, and that's pretty spot on. When we first started going on this, I was actually on vacation in Greece, and I kept reading these stories on my iPad until my wife started to chew me out and said, come on, I mean, you know, you only go on vacation 10 days a year, and what are you doing? You're working. And I turned around and said, look, this is better than any novel. This stuff is just fascinating. This is what I want to read. Strong narratives, exciting events, people giving you real insight into the human condition. And then she rolled her eyes and gave up.
These accounts offer a window into what it was to be an American in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Looking back on their lives, these individuals, who otherwise might have been forgotten by history, reflect on what they achieved and the lives they had led. And this was a time, of course, of huge social change in the United States. For example, Among the people interviewed, there were former slaves like Mariah Jackson.
So Mariah Jackson was somebody who was born into slavery. She was not in good health at the time of the interview. She was in good spirits, though. Like, she had no teeth. They brought her oranges. She could eat those. So she's, it's good that they interviewed her. She was, you know, was very old at the time of the interview. She was a midwife. And she talked a lot about bringing young people into the world and helping these families get started. She had her own children. Some of them survived into adulthood. Some of them didn't. So her talking about delivering babies, it was just clear that that meant a lot to her.
Others spoke of helping to build communities across the U.S., some of which have become cities, and the contribution they made to that economic development.
There's a lot of other people who contributed. And they planted the first trees or put the first well in the towns that they were living in. There's a guy we talk about a lot in the paper, Elmo Acosta. And Elmo was in public service. He was the parks commissioner. He built up the first city nursery. He was in Jacksonville. You know, Jacksonville is a small town and it wasn't a major metropolis. And he built this bridge, which today bears his name. We looked it up. So probably nobody knows who he is, but we know who he is. And maybe he was just bragging. You never know. But he just goes on and on about what he's contributed. So you know that the contributions he made brought meaning into his life.
Mariah and Elmo are just two interviewees with very different backgrounds, experiences, and memories. But can we take their stories and 1,500 others and say something meaningful about what has meaning in our lives, or at least in the lives of Americans during the 1930s? We'll find out how the researchers tackled this question in a moment.
During the early 20th century, many US states had laws in place that imposed restrictions on when and how women were permitted to work. Why and why were they eventually repealed? Anne Hanush of the University of Mannheim explains in our episode, The Laws That Protected Women from Work, from February 2025.
Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile.
On the 18th of March 1968, at the University of Kansas, Bobby Kennedy delivered his famous speech criticizing GDP for measuring everything except that which makes life worthwhile. But many economists have tried to capture what is worthwhile, particularly the satisfaction or the happiness we experience that isn't measured in GDP. If we can measure it, it's the first step in creating ways to improve it, as David explains.
At a basic level, you know, economists think that you get your well-being out of what you get to consume. But obviously, then it's not just you work all day like an ant and you just contribute. You have to actually enjoy some time. So I'd say at a basic level, that's what we teach. You enjoy your leisure time and you enjoy the consumption that you get from your work activities or your investments. And so there's like an old idea that there's a variety of things that give you utility, let's say. You know, living longer is something. And Jones and Kleenow have this great paper saying, you know, low-income countries are not just places where consumption's low, they're places where life expectancy's low. If you go behind the veil of ignorance and you don't know which person in Brazil you're going to be, to use their very nice way of thinking about this, you're worried about inequality in Brazil because there's some extremely rich people in Brazil, extremely poor people in Brazil, and you don't want to be that really poor person. So inequality is something that I guess you'd say inherently care about. We have this holy grail that we can measure somebody's well-being and then we can make policies that improve it. But the truth is we're still trying to understand better what makes people tick and what makes them happy, what makes them have satisfied lives.
Now, at the moment, the only practical way to measure subjective happiness or satisfaction is to ask people how they feel. Most of this research is done using structured surveys. But in this case, how do we analyze thousands of pages of unstructured interviews with no common approach or topic about a far more slippery concept, which is what had meaning in the interviewees' lives? There aren't enough research assistants in the world for such a task. but there is artificial intelligence. When the latest generation of large language models burst onto the scene, it inspired Joachim David and their co-author Stelios Michalopoulos to wonder, should we ask AI to discover and categorize what people found meaningful in their lives? Their early experiments with LLMs reveal both the potential and the limitations of the technology. One of those limitations is, as we have all discovered, an AI will try to reach a conclusion or deliver a response even when there is little or no useful information. In the jargon we've all learned, it can hallucinate, as David found out.
The harder a question you ask, the more likely the LLM is to make something up. If you ask it a hard question, we'll sort of take the question and turn it into an answer, almost like a middle school student who didn't read the book.
Their solution? As they trained their model, they cross-checked its conclusions with human interpretations of these texts. So, as we often do on Vox Talks Economics, let's give special thanks to the many research assistants who were the humans in this particular loop.
Actually, a very large share of the time that we spent on the project was just designing procedures to bring in human validation and make that a rigorous test. How do we actually think about reliability here? What does it mean to be accurate? Because if you ask two humans, they also don't agree, right? I mean, these are complex questions. What brought meaning to your life? If I ask you or your wife, you're not going to agree, probably, at least not at perfect accuracy. So what was relevant here was to say, if the machine agrees or disagrees as much as two humans agree with each other, that's good enough for us. Because then it's basically just like another RA. It's indistinguishable in terms of its inter-rater reliability. And then we could take it to scale. And then we actually see lots of conceptual benefits from using the machine because you don't have this problem that each person sees it differently. Now it's consistent. We know that it's been validated to be fairly reliable, but now it's just one thing applied to 1,500 stories. So the first thing we just wanted to figure out is broad categories of things that bring meaning and purpose. And we wanted to do that bottom up. So we didn't want to sort of say, here's a checklist of eight, pick the one that fits the best. But we let the machine figure out a category in which something might belong and then sort those categories endogenously as they emerge. When we say in this life narrative, for example, there's a lot of emphasis on religion. The human says yes, and then we have seven humans. We want to make sure that the agreement with the modal answer amongst humans is just as high as the agreement of the machine with the modal human. And when we hit that, we say good enough. With a bit of fine-tuning, trying out different machine setups, we get there.
Without some kind of checks and balances, if you will, it's not going to come up with the right answer. And so I hope one of the messages other people take away is that you can't just trust the output.
There's a lot of hit and miss experimentation with the prompt, but we do something very basic in the paper where we try to find the optimum length of the text that we give the machine, right? So if you have very long text, it basically tries to be economical with its own attention and is likely to miss things. If you give it very little text, then complex things like, you know, recurrent themes in the life narrative will be missed. So because we do this consistent human validation where we actually have a gold standard of what the human said, we basically vary both the length of the text chunk and the confidence with which the machine says, I think this is it, to hit this human benchmark. And this is the sort of fine-tuning that allows us to get it to operate just like another RA.
After the break, we'll discuss what the robot RAs discovered. So, of course, what we all want to know is, what does American Life Histories tell us about a meaningful life that other research might have underestimated?
I don't think we're saying that anybody's been wrong in this space, but that they've maybe been missing things. So the standard of comparison is this Harvard retrospective adult development study, where they recruited Harvard undergraduates and then people less socioeconomically advantaged from the south end of Boston, and they follow them over time. And this is considered the main empirical contribution in psychology. And their conclusion is summarized by saying the one thing that really matters in your life is close personal relationships. And we don't really have any beef with that being important, but we find all these other dimensions that also matter a great deal. Work, for example, is the single most important, most frequently mentioned category that brings purpose and meaning to people's lives. Community as well, and then it's families. And this, of course, varies by subgroups. Women are more family-oriented. But the striking thing is really across the social spectrum, across different ethnicities, across men and women, it's pretty stable. They all seem to have this much richer bouquet of different dimensions that actually allow them to tap into meaning and purpose in their lives.
Yeah, there's some pretty interesting differences on those dimensions. So people who are higher up on the socioeconomic ladder end up getting a lot more meaning and satisfaction out of their work. And so some of that may just be they're paid more. You know, it's hard to rule that out. But a lot of it, they talk about autonomy. They talk about being able to do the things that they want to do. It'd be much more rewarding to be working in city government and doing all these things for a community than it would be to just try to get enough income.
Do laundry.
Yeah, there's a character we talk about, Minnie Marshall, who's just trying to get food on the table and pay her rent. And she does laundry. She does these terrible backbreaking jobs. So that one leaps out.
Education looms larger for some people than others. They're not necessarily high SES, but we actually find African-Americans often highlighting education, especially after they moved. Because, you know, getting outside the South means that suddenly you actually have access to public education on a scale that you didn't before.
The contribution of work, meaningful work, and work with autonomy turns out to be an important source of meaning throughout this archive. Now, one way, this should not surprise us, because the people interviewed for American Life Histories had, because of their age and their social situation, often worked hard in punishing jobs for decades. Now, some, of course, had experienced the worst working conditions with no autonomy at all. The interviewees who had lived as slaves talk of long hours, beatings, deprivation. Listen to the recollection of Sarah Gudger, raised a slave in Buncombe County, North Carolina, as recounted to the Federal Writers Project in 1937.
No, I never know what a worse rest. I just work all the time from morning to late at night. I had to do everything they wanted to do on the outside. Work in the field, chop wood, hoe corn, till sometimes I feel like my back shoulder break.
Her brutal life in slavery offered no pleasure or happiness, but no one could deny that it had meaning to her. And this is an important distinction between the studies of happiness or satisfaction that we spoke about earlier and this research. Many of these stories find meaning in enduring hardship or struggle. Women's histories found meaning in negative experiences more than those of men, not least because the number of setbacks and problems that women had endured. Joachim and David also found that immigrants to the US at this time, who had often come halfway around the world and arrived only with what they could carry, who then spent their life struggling to get a foothold in society, were on average more positive and found more meaning out of their lives than those who had been born American.
I don't think heaven can look more beautiful to me than Southern California when we finally got there. Those were great days, all right.
No, gold is not flushing in the streets here, but over here is the standard of living better than over there. Here is a democracy. Today, everybody got to get down on his knees. And thank God he lives in this country.
Joachim explains.
There was this wave of research that actually generated some interesting insights on happiness, right? Where people just did surveys and said, how happy are you? And there's even books saying, you know, this is what we should actually try to maximize instead of output. We want people to be happy. And something that isn't our contribution, but I think that's important conceptually for what we do, is that happiness is basically maximized by having a nice lunch, a nap, and a massage. And we don't think of that as a meaningful life. If you think about your children, every parent knows that they could be extremely painful. So happiness is maybe not maximized by having children, but meaning in your life, certainly for many of us, is maximized by having children. So we wanted to get at this higher level satisfaction. You look back on your life and you say, these are things that I think were actually important. And that's what we're trying to measure.
The events in American Life Histories happened a century ago to people in vanished communities, in homes that are long gone, who did jobs that no longer exist. They never watched television, they never travelled to exotic locations, and they never ordered from Amazon. So can we connect what they found to be meaningful to what today's American or British or Chinese or Rwandan life histories might reveal? For David and Joachim, this focus on labor, the meaning, positive and negative, found in our connection to our work, is an important insight. No one should have to endure the brutality that Sarah Gudger experienced. But should we assume that if we eliminate as much work as possible, that our life automatically becomes more meaningful to us?
It's been in the air for a while, this idea that there's some kind of meaningless jobs, these dead-end jobs you get stuck in. That kind of resonates in the UK. It resonates in places like Germany. You hear people talking about McJobs. There's a button. You press this button. You have no idea what the big picture is, and people are not as motivated if they think they're not contributing to something important. The things that made jobs rewarding back then are probably similar to the things that make jobs rewarding today. They're just sort of different types of jobs.
The 1930s are very different from the present, and the nature of jobs is different. But if you sort of take a very broad view, that people don't just work in order to put food on the table, but there's enormous satisfaction in a job well done. Honing a skill to the point that people will remember you for what you accomplished. There's a lot of satisfaction from recognition and the camaraderie that goes with work. And I think we're undervaluing that by always in economics just talking about income. Now people lose their job. The China shock comes along. Now you're no longer working in the steel mill. You're a greeter at Walmart. And as soon as I pay you the difference between your old job and the new job, I expect you to be just as happy. And that's just missing a huge dimension of what work does.
Some of the jobs people have today in the service sector, to me, strike me as very, very unrewarding. You don't look ahead and say, here's my career. You sort of look ahead and see that the job's going to be automated pretty soon. And in many cases, it is.
I worry a little bit about the extent to which we've decided that work is the enemy. So if you look at policy discussions, especially in Western Europe, the solution is always to cut the working week. And to some extent, I see this amongst millennials, Generation Z, where people basically come in, including in training for highly professional activities, and they talk about work-life balance based on the assumption that there's life, and then this work thing really encroaches on what you want to do. And I don't think that that's going to be a solution long-term. So I think this is an opportunity, but also a challenge.
The discussion paper is 19885, American Life Histories, authors David Lagarkos, Stelios Michalopoulos, and Joachim Voth. You can also look up some of the American Life Histories and learn more about the Federal Writers Project at the American Library of Congress website, which is at loc.gov, loc.gov. Thank you also to the county government at Buncombe for permission to use the audio of Sarah Gudger, as voiced by Becky Stone.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, do elite PhD programs create successful researchers?